introduce Steve Collins.
Well, thank you very much. I want to thank Lon Lacey and the organizers of the feast for inviting me here. You've been so warm and hospitable, and it's really been worth coming. Just a month and a half ago, I had no intention of being at a feast site due to the prolonged injury I've been going through. And when Lon gave me the invitation, it felt like I was just being summoned, that I couldn't say no to it. So here I am. And as some of you know, I was surgically injured in a surgery that wasn't supposed to happen almost two and a half years ago, which resulted in damage to me where I can't sit normally. That's why I have that unique chair back there. And certainly would appreciate your prayers for recovery so I could do more of this in other sites. God inspired many prophecies about the tribes of Israel, as you're familiar with, in the latter days. And unless you know where those tribes are, you can't accurately apply them to today's prophecies. And many people ask, does it matter who Israel is? Does it really make a difference? And all I can say to that is, God thought it made a difference. And if it does to him, it should to us. And to deny that the tribes of Israel will be present in the latter days, you have to deny the word of God itself. God has said they will be here. And since he went to a great pains to give us specific clues about locating them in the latter days in Genesis 49, we should be able to locate them. I believe my book, The Lost Tribes of Israel Found, does indeed follow them throughout history and identify them in the modern world. Now, my book does not simply ask you to take it on faith, quote unquote, my conclusions about the 10 tribes. I've made many efforts to document my conclusions so one can have faith in the facts of history. I should briefly mention that I'm a graduate of the University of Minnesota, which the Pac-10, I believe it is, plays every year in the Rose Bowl. So I'm on the other side of the Rose Bowl, but you won't see the Gophers there very often. In fact, I'd never understood why the Gophers named their mascot after an animal that you usually see as roadkill. It doesn't inspire much fear in anybody. You know, the speaker this morning mentioned the Feast of Tabernacles photo, and one thing I thought I would mention on this, I have petted a lion. And it wasn't an African lion with the mane, it was a full-grown mountain lion, where I was leaving a health club one time and a gentleman had a full-grown mountain lion on a leash. And I thought, is that what I think it is? And he said, yes, he's had it since it was a cub. And I said, can I pet it? I thought this might be the only chance in my life I'll ever do this. And he said, sure, go ahead. So I'm right-handed, so I thought I'd at least use my left. In case everything went totally wrong, at least I would keep my good hand. And sure enough, it just nuzzled like a little tabby cat, a full-grown mountain lion. So it does a little bit of taste of when the lion will lie down with the lamb. Well, my book, I should also mention, includes a full bibliography of sources and a lot of chapter endnotes where you can duplicate the research and see where I got the conclusions. I appreciated the gentleman's discussion this morning or mentioning of Charles Dorothy, who was one of the humblest scholars I ever met and a genuine friend of mine. And in the book, you'll notice where he reviewed certain sections of my application of Hebrew as I wanted him, who's a genuine expert in ancient languages, to look at my conclusions to make sure they were right before they went into print. Now, my book doesn't start with ancient Israel and then skip to the present like a lot of books or pamphlets do, with little information about the intervening years or millennia. My book has much information about what happened to the tribes of Israel throughout history and fills in that empty space. My presentation today will give you some of that material, and I'm hoping there will be room for questions and answers all afterwards. Now, several misconceptions exist about what happened to the house of Israel in about 721 BC. Most believe, one, that all Israel went into captivity with the fall of Samaria. Two, that the 10 tribes opposed Assyria for 3.5 years in Palestine in that last war before Samaria fell. And three, that the 10 tribes became lost nomads that could no longer be identified. Well, all of those above are false statements, based on both secular and biblical evidence. I want to begin with a quote from Josephus, a Jewish historian of the first century AD, which is about 8 centuries after Samaria fell, which confirms that he did not consider the 10 tribes to have ever been lost prior to his lifetime. In the book, his book, Antiquities of the Jews, Book 9, Chapter 5, he writes, "There are but 2 tribes in Asia and Europe subject to the Romans. The 10 tribes are beyond Euphrates till now, and are an immense multitude and not to be estimated by numbers." So Josephus did not consider them lost as of his lifetime. He knew the division of Israel and Judah was still a fact. that they were extremely large in numbers, and he even names the Euphrates River as one of their geographic borders, which will be very important here later. That will be significant later, but I'll hold that for later. For now, I want you to realize that the educated classes of the Jews, like Josephus, knew for many centuries where the ten tribes were and what their condition was. So what did happen to the Israelites around 721 B.C.? Well, 2 Kings 17, 5-6 states, "The king of Assyria went up throughout all the land and went to Samaria and besieged it for 3 years and carried Israel away and placed them in the cities of the Medes." The Bible states the Assyrians went through the land of Israel, but it says nothing about the Assyrians meeting any opposition or resistance till he came to Samaria. Now, 2 Kings 17:24 shows that the rest of the land of Israel was abandoned and had basically reverted to the wild. It talks about wild beasts being in the land. In their own records, the Assyrians claim only about 27,000 plus captives in their final campaign against Israel. They would have gladly claimed more if they were theirs. The Assyrians were not reluctant to boast about their accomplishments. There just weren't any more. Where did they go? Well, about 60 years before Samaria's fall, to give you an idea of the size of Israel that was still in the land, 2 Chronicles 25 states that Judah hired 100,000 Israelite soldiers for a particular war. Now, that's a lot of Israelite soldiers just to subcontract a portion of their army. Now, in about 750 B.C., Israel and Judah got into a war, and Israel killed 120,000 Jews in one day. They were carrying 200,000 Jews into captivity until God stopped it. That's in 2 Chronicles 28, that story. Now, obviously, the house of Israel still had to be pretty large to be carrying 200,000 captives into captivity to Israel. That only 27,000 men, women, and children were taken captive later in Samaria leaves a lot of the majority of the ten tribes unaccounted for. Now, to understand where the bulk of the ten tribes went in 721 B.C. or so, we need to discuss the fact that Israel had a whole network of colonies up to that time. Obviously, if there was a system of colonies, these would be safe havens from the Assyrians. Now, God had promised Abraham that his seed would be multiplied very greatly. When God was blessing Abraham, if he was keeping his promise, we could hardly expect their numbers to be contained in that little nation of Palestine. Now, when you read the history books, you'll occasionally see reference to the Phoenician Empire. In about 1000 to 700 B.C., which coincidentally was Israel's golden age, or when Israel was in existence there, that is when Phoenicia was credited as being the world empire that was the greatest at that time. It was built by David and Solomon with their allies from Tyre and Sidon. Now, the Israelites and Phoenicians spoke different dialects of the same language. Hiram and David conversed very easily. Their navies were commingled with common crews, as it says in the Bible. But the Phoenicians never called themselves by that name. That is a Greek name for that alliance. And our history comes from the Greco-Roman perspective, so that's why we call them Phoenicians. The Greek term for Phoenicia, according to Homer and other Greek writers, included Palestine. It was the whole area of the eastern Mediterranean. So from 1000 to 700 B.C., when you see the term Phoenicia, understand that the Greeks named that region. When they did so, they included the land of the Kingdom of Israel in that definition. Now, history shows the Phoenicians had established a network of colonies and trading posts throughout the Mediterranean world and on the west coast of Africa and Asia. The Phoenician Empire's names and coins included a slogan called, and I can't write it for you, but it included the term BRT. You see that slogan a lot on Phoenician coins and on their place names. Well, in Hebrew, BRT is the root word of the word covenant. And Israel, of course, was the covenant people. So the Phoenicians were really proclaiming themselves as the covenant people and identifying themselves as that. Carthage was later founded as a colony by the Israelite Phoenicians in about the time of Ahab's great drought. But Carthage also used that designator, BRT, in its coinage also. It is so common, in fact, in Phoenician names, it shows the dominant role of the covenant people there. That Hebrew word, based on the consonants BRT, is still used in the Jewish organization today known as B'nai B'rith, or B'rith. The BRT is the consonant root words, as the vowels weren't rendered in the ancient languages. Now, the Bible says in 1 Kings 10, 24-25, that Solomon had an international empire and reputation. Evidence exists showing the Israelites also came to North America. The Phoenician Baal worshippers had a colony in ancient America. The inscriptions and monuments, etc., are detailed in my book, but originally in Dr. Barry Fell's trilogy of books, America B.C., Saga America, and Bronze Age America. I'm only going to cite a few of those things because I believe Doug Jones will be discussing more of those tomorrow, and rather than be repetitious, I'll just give you the high points of that, but my book goes into it in great detail. These Israelite Phoenicians who were Baal worshippers had a 20-acre temple to Baal in New Hampshire. It was so huge, the monuments and the complexes there, towns in Massachusetts disassembled them during our colonial period and made their streets out of them. Now, as Barry Fell has discussed in the Epigraphic Society Occasional Publications, I think it was, rather than one of his books, epigraphers would, when they found out that these were the bricks that had come from that complex, they were going along and inspecting them, looking for the inscriptions that would still be available, and they could find them. And the pagan gods you see referred to in the Bible are mentioned on those bricks. Now, also, a trilingual stele depicting a pagan celebration or human sacrifices around a maypole was found in Davenport, Iowa, up in my area of the Midwest. It had three languages, the ancient North African, which was really the language of the Sea Peoples, Egyptian hieroglyphics, and Iberian Punic, which is a descendant of the Hebrew. These date from before, during, and after Israel's Golden Age. Now, the worshippers of the true God were here also. As a number of you in New Mexico last year at the feast at Albuquerque, I would have loved to have seen that with you, in Las Lunas, where the Ten Commandments are written on the rock. Also in 1860, a tablet called Decalogue Tablet was dug out of the Mound Builders area in the Ohio River Valley. You've all been told that these are Indian monuments, etc., and that you can't dig in there now. I think one reason they don't want to dig in those areas is they desperately do not want to find what's there. Because when one of them was excavated in 1860, it turned out it was Semitic, and it had Semitic names, etc., and dedications in it. They even had an old copper hide coin currency, which was used in the ancient world. Now, why are these facts not known in ancient history books? Now, one comment about the time of King David. Israel became the dominant power in the ancient world. I'm not the first to say that. In as sources, many as I think of you have, Halley's Bible Handbook, Henry Halley also asserted the same thing. Secular records confirm that Assyria was defeated by Semitic invaders from the west, coming from the direction of Israel, during the reign of King David. Now, the Bible hints at how this started in 1 Chronicles 19. It says Asher in the King James, or Assyria, and the Mesopotamian powers had joined in a surprise attack to annihilate Israel. Joab turned the tables on them and won that battle. But David, as a man of the sword as he was, is not the forgive-and-forget type. The Assyrians had tried to annihilate him and his army. You can see in my book the evidence that these invaders that came from the west that spoke Semitic were Israelites, and they actually occupied Assyria at that particular time. The consistent animosity that Assyria had toward Israel afterwards is explained by this, because Assyria had a great grudge against Israel for being occupied by them for a particular period of time. I don't have time to examine that remarkable event today in full detail, but my book does have that. Now, when Israel fell, I'm talking about the time of Samaria, it was similar to what would have happened if Great Britain had fallen in World War II to Hitler's forces, but had carried on the battle from their colonies and with the English Navy. Now, Britain itself had been an Israelite colony for over 300 years when Samaria fell. It was called Early Britain, and it has those consonants B-R-T in it, the Hebrew name for covenant. So the British Isles have been named with that covenant term since about the time of King David. Now, when Samaria fell, some of the tribes sailed for the British Isles. I'm sure some of you are aware that the Simonii, or the tribe of Simeon, arrived by sea in 720 B.C. in Wales, and the early Welsh called themselves the Brith of Brithan, or the Briths of Britain, and there's that B-R-T again, saying that they were the covenant people. Now, at least some of the tribe of Asher was already in Britain. William Camden's Britannia, a book written in 1808, recorded that the early English history stated, and I quote, that the merchants of Asher worked the tin mines of Cornwall as masters and exporters. It's remarkable what you can find in some of the early English histories and books, what they acknowledge about the biblical characters and personalities we knew. The Tuatha de Danann, or the tribe of Dan, arrived in Ireland about the same time, but that was just a portion of the tribe of Dan. Many Israelites fleeing the Assyrians undoubtedly went a shorter distance to Carthage on the North African coast and gave it the influx of population that resulted in it becoming a great power. Again, Carthage never called itself Carthage. We have that name because the Romans called them Carthage, and our history is taught from the Roman perspective. Now, more on that later. But first, I want to give you a surprise, at least it is historically to most people. Evidence exists that the majority of the Israelites did not choose to either go into captivity in Assyria or risk voyages to new lands, but instead migrated voluntarily and conquered a new homeland. In 1875, an official of Queen Victoria's English government, he was Keeper of the Crown Jewels, Colonel Gawler, wrote a paper entitled "Our Scythian Ancestors Identified with Israel," which cited many classical and medieval sources, confirming that a large portion of Israelites migrated north of Israel through Armenia and became what is known the Black Sea Scythians, or Sakae, as the Greeks called them. Sakae is S-A-C and A-E is their plural, but Sak is obviously the word Isaac, or Isaac. Ortelius, a 16th century geographer for the Spanish king, wrote that when the Israelites retreated into the Caucasus, they took the name Gothi, and were very jealous of the glory of God. Now, the Romans called the Gothi the Goths, which we'll hear a lot about later in history. A medieval Jewish writer by the name of Eldad wrote, and I quote, "Many Israelites did not go into captivity, but evaded the calamity, and going off with their flocks and turning nomads, and that the chief or prince whom they appointed could muster 120,000 horsemen and 100,000 foot soldiers." Now, this is where most of the 10 tribes went, with an armed escort of 250,000 men. The whole nation must have numbered perhaps 1.5 to 2 million easily at that time. Now, the Greeks and Romans knew about these people a great deal and called them Gothi, Sakae, Scythians, but the Bible mentions them too. 100 years after Samaria's fall, Jeremiah 3, verses around 10 to 12, includes God's own comment when he told Jeremiah to bring a message to Israel, which God says was then more righteous than Judah. And God says they were located toward the north. Now, draw a line north of Palestine on a globe, and you'll come right to the Black Sea region where escaping Israel went, confirming the secular sources that said they went to the same area. So we have in the Word of God that he knew where they were as well. Now, the smallest group of Israelites in around 721 B.C. were the diehards who holed up in Samaria for that siege. About 27,000 were left at the end. Those were the ones who were relocated to the cities of the Medes. Now, some significant observations can be made about the Israelites leaving Palestine. The Bible shows the prophets warned the 10 tribes that Assyria would conquer Israel. Since many left voluntarily, the majority, and only 27,000 stayed to resist, it indicates that the 10 tribes heeded the prophets and left, saving themselves in the process, at least physically. Now, regarding the Scythians, the Sakae that were in the Black Sea region, Herodotus, the famous Greek historian and geographer, stated, "They make no offerings of pigs, nor will they keep them at all in their country." I'll bet you didn't realize the Scythians were kosher. Now, the absence of idols in the Scythian relics also argues they began their nation with some fear of God. In fact, one Scythian king, who's named in the records, was executed by his own people for participating in a pagan Greek ceremony. It was a ritual in honor of Bacchus, the wine god, with a wanton orgy, etc. But the Scythian king camouflaged himself. He basically dressed in drag to come to this particular thing, but he was seen by some Scythians. They chased him down and killed him for participating in that and got a new king. So the people themselves had to have some zeal for God to do that. Now, there had to be a historic parting of the ways when Samaria fell, before Assyria came. Those who feared God went north to a new land. Those who stayed with Baal worship or kept it in their traditions went west by boats. The defenders of Samaria bought time for the rest of the Israelites to escape, and in fact, we have a similar analogy in our own history of the Alamo, which bought time for the rest of Texas to, in that case, rally their army to defeat Santa Anna. But in this case, it just bought time for the Israelites to leave. Now, the Scythians are recorded as arriving in the Eurasian areas during the 8th and 7th centuries. There's no record of them being there before that. That's exactly the time and exactly the place our earlier sources place the Israelites who fled Assyria. Now, the Greeks called them the Sakae. The Persians called them Saka, spelling it with a K, but that's more the Semitic variant of Isaac's name, Yitzhak, with a K. Now, Genesis 21:12 records for us that God promised Abraham that his descendants would be named by the name of Isaac. And those vowels were not written in ancient languages, so you see a variety of variants of his name. But the Scythian rule and influence spread from as far as the Balkans on the west and East Europe, across South Russia, and to the border of China, and into the area of what we would call East Asia. So they were extremely numerous at that particular time. Okay, the Scythians renamed the rivers emptying into the Black Sea and called them by the names Danube, Dnieper, Dniester, and Don, after the tribe of Dan, all Israelite names. In 624 B.C., the Scythians invaded and conquered all of Asia Minor, Syria, Palestine, and Mesopotamia. Nineveh and Assyria's empire were destroyed by the Israelites. So the Bible leaves you with the impression that the Israelites never did have any justice with the Assyrians or ended up the losers. A little over, well, around 100 years later, it was Israel that gave the coup de grace to the Assyrian empire. Now, Egypt paid tribute to these Scythians to keep them from invading Egypt. Now, the Scythians were protective of the Jews in Judah, doing no harm to them during the reign of King Josiah. Now, their presence is mentioned in the Bible in 2 Chronicles 34:9 and 35:18. But again, since the Bible wasn't written from a Greco-Roman perspective, they don't call them the Scythians or the Sakae. They call them names like Manasseh, Ephraim, the remnant of Israel, or Israel that was present. Now, at the time secular history records that there were many Scythians pouring through Palestine, the Bible mentions that the tribes of Israel were physically back in Palestine. Now, some people who haven't done their research deep enough have looked at that and say, well, see, this shows Israel never left. They're still in the land, so they were just mingled with the Jews. No, it doesn't. When you see that the Scythians had invaded that area and had come back into the land, and when you discover who they were, it explains what the Bible's talking about. So the Israelites had their vengeance against Assyria, and they were in their old homeland, probably intending to stay. But after 100 years of foreign occupation, Palestine was no longer a land of milk and honey. Scythia, where they had come from, South Russia, was so fertile and roomy that Palestine wasn't worth the bother. And history records, and there's different renditions of history, or some say they stayed 10 years, some say they stayed up to 24. But they voluntarily, at the top of their game, having this whole empire conquered, just voluntarily left and said, bye, we're heading back to South Russia. So they left Mesopotamia and Mideast, created a void, and retreated to Scythia undefeated after about 20 years. The Scythians were isolationist. Their entire pattern was a live and let live attitude. Now that sounds a lot like a modern nation I know whose armies liberate nations in World War I and World War II, and then don't keep that empire for themselves, but go back to their farms and jobs. That's not an accident, as I'll bring out. The Scythian Empire was one of the largest ever, from about 624 to 600 B.C., but they're almost never discussed in your history texts, that the Scythians gave up conquered land to go back and live in peace in their own territory is very unusual. Now, Scythia was not a single authoritarian ruled empire with one king over all of it. It was a confederation of allied tribes and clans without a central government over the whole region. Now, the Greek writer Epiphanius stated that the laws, customs, and manners of the Scythians were received by other nations as the standards of civility and polite learning. Now, we think the Greeks were the ones who were the great civilizers, but here's a Greek writer saying the Scythians set the standards of polite learning. Paul agrees. In Colossians 3:11, he draws a series of contrasts where he refers to, he says, there is neither Jew nor Greek, bond nor free. The next dichotomy he brings is Scythian or barbarian. So he uses the two terms as direct opposites. Paul knew who they were too. Now, I want to discuss that in 528 B.C., Cyrus the Great of Persia mustered his empire and attacked the Scythians living north of the Caspian and Aral Sea. Now, that was a long way from home for Cyrus. Persia attacked the main tribe of the Sakae living in that area, which was the Massa Getae. Now, Getae was a Greek term for the Goths, and Massa, I believe, was Manasseh, as I bring out in the book. Scythia was ruled by a queen named Tamiris. This is how it comes to us in English in the spelling. Let me see if the blue works better.
I don't know if you can read this. It's not drawn to scale, but the consonants are T, M, and R.
Now, in the Bible, there's two mentions of Tamaris as being a daughter name in King David's royal line. And he was also promised that his seed would be ruling over the descendants of the 10 tribes of Israel. So here we see a queen with a Davidic name in it. She urged Cyrus to go home so both nations could live in peace, but promised him his fill of blood if he refused. And he refused. The Greeks recorded a great deal about this time, but this Tamaris is really an ancient iron lady like Maggie Thatcher. She was a tough bird. And I have some information about her in the book, but Persia invaded. Most Herodotus, the Greek historian, states that most of the Persians died on the spot. Among them, King Cyrus himself died. Now, round two came in 512 BC when King Darius invaded Scythia, but this time he stayed away from the western ones. He went to the eastern Scythians by the Black Sea, but he invaded them with an army of 700,000. The Scythians sent their families further and further to the north, lengthening the Persian supply lines. Finally, the Scythians sent an ambassador to Darius with a very strange message. And it gives you an indication of the specifics that the Greeks have preserved about this time, that we can even have this message preserved for us with such specificity. The message was, they sent to them a bird, a mouse, a frog, and a clump of arrows, with instructions that the Persians, if they were smart, could figure it out for themselves. The message that the Persians figured out was essentially, unless you fly like birds, burrow like mice, or can leap into the water like frogs, you will all die from our arrows. I think that was the right message. The Persians immediately packed their bags and ran for home. They lost 70,000 men in the battles on the way out. Now, that's 20,000 more than the United States lost in 14 years in Vietnam. That gives you the example of the intensity of what the hand-to-hand warfare could be like at that time. But I want to mention that one of the key Scythian national symbols was an eagle. You can even see a Scythian eagle crest that's very similar to the crest of the United States, only the neck of the eagle is aiming down. But the clump of arrows was their war sign. Now, what modern nation has an eagle in its crest as its symbol and a clump of arrows as its war sign? The United States. We do. The eagle crest has one talon holding olive branches as a symbol of peace. Another clump of arrows in the other talon as its war sign. Now, Scythia was never again seriously challenged by anyone from the Gentile empires to the south. I think the great image of Daniel 2 that Nebuchadnezzar saw needs to be understood as representing the succession of Gentile world empires, not as an image of all world empires, because the Gentile empires were frequently defeated by the Israelite empires that you hear very little about. Now the focus needs to shift to another empire of the Israelites. This is the one founded in the Mediterranean by the refugees from the Assyrians, and it's known to us as Carthage. In the mid-9th century B.C., Israel and Phoenicia were devastated by the 3.5-year drought which Elijah had prayed for. It was so severe, the rivers were drying up, the population was dying, the land couldn't support them. You remember the account of Elijah, who was fed for a time by a brook by the ravens. But then God moved him to a widow's house in Zarephath. Now, interestingly, Zarephath was a suburb of Sidon, which is where Queen Jezebel was from, and it was Queen Jezebel who was looking for Elijah to kill him. So Elijah's place of safety at that time that God chose for him was in a suburb of Queen Jezebel's hometown. So I don't know what that tells us about now, but God might pick unusual places to protect his people, because he certainly did in Elijah's case. He put him in a place where Jezebel would never have dreamed to look for him. Now, there's a lesson here, though. God caused Elijah to go through the same experience that Elijah asked God to send on his nation. God could have sent him, take a boat to Carthage, take a boat to Britain, go somewhere else and, you know, where there's abundance of food and there's rain. No, God told him to stay in Israel. He said he'd keep him alive, but he kept him in Israel. I think there's a lesson for us in this. What are your prayers Or what are my prayers for our nation? Is it, well, punish them, Lord, send them into captivity, they're just a bunch of sinners? Or is it, spare your people, Lord, have mercy on them, give them repentance, and deliver them from their enemies, save them? Be careful how you pray for your nation. When God appoints people as watchmen, we have a precedent in Elijah's life that God can let his people taste the same conditions they ask God to send on their nation. Now, history records Carthage was founded at the time of this drought. The Carthaginians, of course, never called themselves Carthage. That was the Roman term. We know them by the term of Kiriath Hadasha. They call themselves Kiriath Hadasha. It's preserved in the records, but that's Hebrew for new town or new city. Now, many sources state that the leaders of Carthage were called the Shophetim. I won't write it down, but there's a book in your Bible with that name. It's called Judges. In Hebrew, that's Shophetim. Now, there's no record of a Carthaginian king until, or any Carthaginian leader claiming the title king, until after the kingdom of Israel fell. Now, as a colony of Israel, because the land of Israel could not support very many people when there's no rain. They had to move their people or they died. Put yourself in their place. Would you stay in Israel and say, yeah, I think I'll just stay here and starve? Or would you get on a boat or move by land somewhere where there was rain? I think that's what we'd all do. But as a colony of Israel, their first king was King Ahab of Israel. Its kings were the kings of Israel as long as Israel had kings. Carthage was a crown colony of Israel, as we would put it, and their leaders were called judges. They had no right to the term king until after Israel fell. Now, 1 Kings 18 records that Ahab went looking all over the world for Elijah during this drought. He made a worldwide search, and it says he took an oath from every nation where he sent his messengers that they had searched and he wasn't there. So again, they were searching everywhere but Jezebel's hometown. Now, if Ahab was the head of a little two-bit shepherd kingdom in the Mideast, no one would have paid any attention to him. However, Ahab was the head of the Phoenician alliance. Remember Phoenicia with Israel, that land allied with Tyre and Sidon, etc.? They had, at that time, and had for many centuries, the biggest navy in the world. They had a lock on all the maritime trade routes. If you didn't get along with them, you didn't trade, or you didn't go anywhere by sea. Now, at that time, he probably had the biggest navy in the world, because they had to take the timber and make ships to export their population. So their navy was probably the largest in its history at that particular time. No nation that wanted access to the maritime trade routes dared defy King Ahab, now, who was also very angry at that time. Now, the priests of Carthage were called, if I can write it, does this show up at all on the red is better? Okay. Don't think that's going to erase. I'm going to save that the rest of the space for something more important later. Anyway, the priests of Carthage were called the Kohanim. The Hebrew word, of course, that we get that is named this are the Kohens. So when you meet a Jewish friend named Kohen, that's priest. It's a root word of that. The chief priest was the Rab Kohanim of Carthage, or we get the word rabbi, which was Hebrew for the great or the master priest. Regarding the priestly laws of Carthage, two separate secular historians have noted that the sacrificial and priestly rites bore a very significant resemblance to the book of Leviticus. The Encyclopedia Judaica adds, and I quote, "Modern scholars maintain the expansion of the Phoenicians to Carthage owed something to the collaboration of the Hebrews." Well, in this case, the Judaica got it right, where the other encyclopedias don't mention this. Carthage fought many wars with the Greeks, and Carthage's navy was so strong, as the inheritors of the Phoenician mantle, that they refused access to the Atlantic to the Greek vessels. Now, as an aside here, you've all been taught that ancient man believed that there was a flat earth, that if you sailed off the end, you know, you would go off and never be heard from again. We get that idiotic myth from the Greco-Roman tradition, and I say that because the Phoenicians and Carthaginians sailed huge ships called hippos. They were so large. The Greeks recorded that they sent colonizing expeditions of thousands of men and women on boats, hundreds per ship, sent them through the Straits of Gibraltar off to some unknown colony across the Atlantic. Now, those hippos were huge. I mean, compared to Columbus's ship, Columbus's ships were like glorified lifeboats compared to what the Phoenicians and Carthaginians sailed. And the Carthaginians and the Phoenicians before them They had a real good disinformation campaign. They were the masters of the ocean. They knew the wealth that was on this side or anywhere else, and they wanted to scare all their rivals off, so they kept their monopoly. It was a state policy to lie to these people about all the sea monsters that are out there. You know, that earth, we've seen ships, no kidding, they've gone like that. They believed them, that propaganda, and besides, just in case they believed, the Carthaginians placed their navy by Gibraltar so no one could get out of the Mediterranean. The reason the Greeks and Romans thought the world was flat was because they were landlocked. They never got out into the big oceans where the Phoenicians and Carthaginians sailed. We have this absurd notion that the first time any ancient person learned anything, it had to be either a Greek or a Roman. You know, nobody could know anything until the Greeks and Romans knew it first. That's the image we get in our history texts. Well, if the Carthaginian sailors could be resurrected and learned that thousands of years later, we're still teaching that the Greeks and Romans were the standards of knowledge on nautical matters, and that we really believe that the earth was flat, they would absolutely laugh in their graves if they could find out that their propaganda was still being printed in our textbooks today. So, to get my place here, I had a digression there. Oh yes, but Carthage had a lockhold on Gibraltar, which was one of the gates of their enemies, a promise that God had made to the Israelites via Abraham. Now the Greeks had to rely on spies or seaport scuttlebutt to learn what Carthage had found out there in the Atlantic, because it was a key to their wealth. They had an endless source of raw materials coming from somewhere. Frederick Pohl's book, Atlantic Crossings Before Columbus, quotes two ancient Greek accounts of the secret Atlantic land of Carthage. The first one I'm sure you've heard of. It was Aristotle. This is what Aristotle wrote, and I quote, "In the sea outside the pillars of Hercules, or Gibraltar, they say an island was found by the Carthaginians, a wilderness with navigable rivers, many days sailing westward, and the Carthaginians, who were the masters of the Western Ocean, when they observed that many traders, attracted by the soil fertility, some resided there, they feared that knowledge of that land would reach other nations. Therefore, the Senate of Carthage issued a decree that no one under penalty of death would be allowed to sail there. So Carthage went to great pains to keep this land secret, but as we will see, they did explore and inhabit it. The second account is from a Greek writer of the first century B.C. He wrote, there lies a very great island in the vast ocean, many days sail westward from Libya. Its soil is very fruitful. A great part of it is mountainous, but much likewise is a plain watered with navigable rivers. The mountainous part of the country is clothed with very large forests, and you may hunt all sorts of wild beasts in this land." Obviously, he's describing North America, and it shows the Carthaginians explored it pretty extensively. And Carthaginian coins, writings, artifacts such as an atlatl, a spear-throwing device with a Carthaginian inscription on it, they've been found and identified in Colorado, New York, Alabama, Connecticut, Nevada, Georgia, and other places. Why isn't this in the textbooks? Someone doesn't want the truth known. Carthage merely inherited the territories long known to the Phoenicians, who had a colony here before Carthage was ever founded. Now, a group called the Adena people, that's what secular scholars call them in the United States, inhabited the Ohio River Valley from about 1000 B.C. That's where they date it to. They don't realize they're targeting the time of King David and King Solomon, until they're merging with what they call the Hopewell people around 300 to 200 B.C., and then they thrive till about 700 or 500 A.D. Now, 300 to 200 B.C. coincides with the Second and Third Punic Wars, where Carthage was finally being worn down and defeated by Rome, and when more Carthaginians, who had a huge city, when the Romans conquered it, most of them were unaccounted for again. Well, they had huge fleets, and they disappeared. Where did they go? Over here. And we find that there was even secular historians can find there was a huge infusion of new people here in the New World. They call them the Hopewell people around 300 to 200 B.C. Coincidentally, the same time that hundreds of thousands of Carthaginian and Punic people suddenly needed a new home, and they had the fleets to get here, and they knew about this land. But the remnants of their culture baffled the early American colonists when our nation was founded. This is a quote from the Epigraphic Society Occasional Publications. I don't have the name of the author in front of me, but I wanted to credit where it came from. The quote is, "When the first settlers moved westward from the American colonies, they discovered the great burial mounds and earthworks, which were obviously the work of man, but also obviously not within the capacity or even tribal memories of the Indian tribes. President Jefferson, President Harrison, scientists and clergymen speculated they were built by Egyptian, Norsemen, or the lost tribes of Israel. Now, how many of you heard in your history books that at least two American presidents felt that the lost tribes of Israel had been here and built those mounds? Now, also, about 1000 B.C., the metallurgists and the archaeologists can determine that the Lake Superior iron mines were worked to exhaustion of their iron, that they ran dry about 1000 B.C., but there was no evidence it was ever used anywhere in the New World. Well, coincidentally, the Bible mentions that's the same time period that David was preparing iron in abundance for the Temple of Solomon. He wasn't allowed to build it, but he was allowed to store and preposition all the materials for the temple, which he did. And he worked those mines to exhaustion, is what my book maintains, because you have a perfect match. You have iron mines in the New World that were just suddenly worked out around 1000 B.C. I forget how many millions and millions of pounds of iron ore they calculate were taken out of there. But then we suddenly have, in Israel, King David accumulating iron in abundance beyond numbering it in a land that did not have iron ore like that. So I think we know where it came from. Now, turn the page. One of the artifacts in these Edina graves was translated by Professor Barry Fell as in the Punic language, which was the language of Carthage, in the form of an alphabet used in Iberia, that's Spain, in the first millennium B.C. Punic was the descendant of the Hebrew language used by Carthage. So North Africa, or North America, was inhabited by Israelite people from about 1000 B.C. till around 500 A.D., first by Phoenicia, then Carthage, then Celts also, who were here. And then they were cut off from the Old World during the very appropriately named Dark Ages, when a lot of knowledge was lost. When the Saxon and European nations repopulated North America in the modern era, they were merely re-inheriting what God had long ago given their ancestors. Now, Rome and Carthage became mortal enemies. Carthage, for centuries, was greater than Rome. In a treaty about 348 B.C., Carthage was still so strong, it forbid the Roman ships to even enter the Western Mediterranean, with two exceptions. If they needed their ships repaired, or they wanted to take on cargo, then they could come. You know, if they could make money in the deal, then they would be allowed to come. Now, Carthage almost did destroy the Roman Empire. I'm sure you've heard of Hannibal when he crossed the Alps with those battle elephants. You've probably seen documentaries on the Discovery Channel or Learning Channel like I have. Very fascinating. They rampaged in Italy for years. But the Carthaginians had a habit of taking those battle elephants wherever they went because they realized what terror it struck in the hearts of their enemies to see this giant beast being ridden by people throwing spears or arrows at him, the trumpet of an elephant, when you'd never seen one. That would be terrifying. I mean, would you want to stand up to a charging elephant with nothing but a sword in your hand? Well, my book brings out the fact that elephant, and specifically African elephant remains, have been found in ancient America. They've dug up their skeletons. Certain Indian tribes had legends that those animals still existed when in their tribal memories. Now, Baal worship became the undoing of Carthage in both North Africa and North America. They degenerated, practiced massive human sacrifices. But to leave them alone at this point in my presentation, I want to close with mentioning they were a huge wheat exporter, tremendous agriculturalists. North Africa was fertile then. It was the Romans that destroyed the soil fertility of North Africa. The Romans record that the Carthaginians were methodical cattle breeders, which is something which Jacob did, as you can see in the book of Genesis when he was with Laban. The Carthaginians, they say, invented a threshing machine for their wheat, which the Romans called a sledge, fitted with small toothed wheels in a gearing action. So the Carthaginians were going through their wheat fields with probably what looked like Midwestern America before the internal combustion engine was invented, with a horse-drawn threshing machine of some kind through their wheat fields. Now I'll discuss the next Israelite empire, which rose to greatness in Asia and became Rome's superpower rival. That's called Parthia. If I asked you what nation was founded when it declared its independence from a powerful empire, had to fight for that independence for years, and then celebrated their Independence Day as a national holiday, what nation would you answer? And also a nation that grew into a superpower and pioneered greater freedoms for its people. Would you answer the United States? Well, if so, you'd be right. But if you answered Parthia, you would also be right. Now, the Parthians were blood relatives of the Scythians and fellow tribes. George Rawlinson, the famous British historian, wrote that the Scythic character of the Parthian Parthians is asserted in the strongest terms by the ancient writers. There's no record of them prior to the time the Israelites went into captivity. The Greek historians show the Parthians passed from the dominion of the Assyrians to that of the Medes to that of the Persians. That's an apt description of what happened to the Israelites who did go into captivity. Now, after Persia fell, the Parthians were ruled by Alexander the Great and then the Seleucid Greek Empire. Now, Parthia declared its independence in about 250 A.D. Their first king and the city of his coronation were both named after Isaac. The king was Arsaces, that was a generic title with S-A-C in it, and the city was Asac, almost exactly word for word Isaac. King David was promised by God that David would never want descendants sitting on the throne of the house of Israel. Jeremiah 33:17 is one of those promises where it's recorded. So we must have his seed ruling over the descendants of the 10 tribes for that promise to be true. Now, David was of the line of, was it red that worked better? I'll write this. David was of the line of... for red. Okay. Now, the Scythian kings had this name in a lot of their titles. There was a Scythian king in Iberia who was named Pharasmenes, and a whole series of them were named that, in the nation of Iberia, which was named after Eber, the father of the Hebrews, near the Black Sea. There was a Parthian sub-king named Gondophares or Gondophares, which ruled in the area of West India. You see his name associated with the three magi or wise men who came to visit Christ many times. The Greeks Hellenized the spelling of the Parthian king names, but the consonants still had P-H-R-S in them, the name of Phares. They spelled it like Phraates, Phraortes, and by the way, you can buy Parthian coins. The Greeks Hellenized the spelling of the Parthian king names, but the consonants still had P-H-R-S in them, the name of Phares. They spelled it like Phraates, Phraortes, and by the way, you can buy Parthian coins at virtually any antiquity dealers. They're so common, they're all over Asia, and they're dug up very commonly, and I bought one from one of the Parthian kings, and I probably should have brought it. You could have held a little bit of history in your hand. But anyway, the antiquities dealers, you can order these, and frequently they just offer them in their catalogs, and you can say, well, which king of the Parthians do you want? There's so many. And yet we don't hear anything about this empire. Throughout all its history, Parthia was ruled by kings with the Davidic names in them that periodically resurfaced. Now remember that the coins of the ancient kingdom of Israel had that Hebrew word BRT in it? At least two historical sources state that in the ancient Semitic tongues, the P and the B were interchangeable. They were both what's called labial consonants for those who study language. You can, you know, enunciate a P or B sound. They're very similar. Now, the city of Tarsus, where the Apostle Paul was from, was called by the Phoenicians Parthenia. So the name Parthia was even there in the Phoenician tradition. But if you change the, well, I don't have it up here, but if you change the Parthian P to a B, you have that Berith or B-R-T-H again for the covenant people. Now, they grew too numerous to count in Asia, as Josephus mentioned. Now, they came to be known by their sub-tribal names. Now, Numbers 26 gives us a lot of those clan names. Now, those are the really boring parts of the Bible. If you read through them, you know, the begats, so-and-so begat so-and-so, and so-and-so begat so-and-so. And you try to stay awake when you read that. But those are absolutely essential chapters if you're trying to follow the tribes of Israel in history. Now, it names in Numbers 26 that Ephraim had three sub-tribes, the Eranites, the Bactrites, and the Tahanites. Now, the three tribes that history tells us were formed, or that the Parthian Empire was formed from, were the Iranians, the Bactrians, and the Dahanites. The Iranites, with a perfect Ephraimite name, lived in the Parthian-Persian area, in the cities of the Medes, which is where Samaria was placed. It's called Iran to this day. Now, if the Ayatollahs of Iran knew that their nation was named after a sub-tribe of Ephraim, I think they would change the name tomorrow. The Bactrites gave their name to Bactria. The first king of Parthia came from there. The Dahanites were also identified with this. So Parthia was really formed by an Ephraimite reunion. The chief tribe, on the other hand, of the Scythians were the Massagetae that the Persians had tried to beat and couldn't. So Ephraim and Manasseh were the two chief tribes of these two separate empires. Often Manasseh came to the aid of Ephraim in major wars. Scythia would aid Parthia, just as the United States aided Ephraim in wars. Now let's examine the history of this very powerful but little known Asian empire. And I think it's worth pointing out that I'm going to give you the story, for many of you, if not most or all of you, the story of your blood ancestors. They lived through these times. They lived these events. And if you could have them all resurrected in a chain, you would get back to the people who say, yes, I lived through that. So we're talking about our forefathers. In the 1870s, George Rawlinson wrote exhaustive histories of the Parthians. And he comments, and I quote, "The picture of the world during the Roman period commonly put before students was defective, false, in its omission to recognize the real position of Parthia, a rival state dividing with Rome the sovereignty of the known earth. From first to last, there was always a second power which balanced Rome. This power for nearly three centuries was Parthia." Now, Parthia had existed for almost two centuries before they really came into contact with Rome. The Seleucid Greeks were their adversary at that time. So Parthia was rising as Carthage was falling. And you can see that there's a divine plan, I would propose to you, withdrawing blessings from one and giving them to the other. So there was always an Israelite empire to compensate or compete with the Gentile empire at the time. Now, Daniel's 70 weeks prophecy of Daniel 9 says, 70 weeks are determined upon thy people, Daniel, as Daniel was confessing the sins of both Israel and Judah in his prayer. Daniel was an Israelite as well as a Jew. When he says thy people, when it says thy people, the 70 weeks prophecy applies for both Israel and Judah. Now, you're familiar with how 70 years applies from the going forth of the decree to rebuild Jerusalem for 70 years in Christ's life. But for Israel's, if you take one day equaling a prophetic year, you get 70 times 7, that's 490 years. Well, the kingdom of Israel fell in stages from around 740 B.C. when Gilead and Naphtali were taken captive to 721 B.C. Parthia rose, according to the secular histories, from about in stages from 250 to 231 B.C. When you take both of those dates, you come to 490 years. Which exactly fits the 70 weeks prophecy for Israel. Daniel, of course, also in Daniel 9:7, talked about Israel that was near and Israel that was afar off. So he knew that portions of Israel by then were nowhere near Persia. So Parthia grew under several monarchs to true empire status, and they ruled from, say, West India, the Indus River, to the Euphrates River. There's a great Parthian monarch, Mithridates I, who did much of that expansion. Rawlinson quotes that he was a brave, energetic, good general, but an excellent administrator. Have you ever heard of him in your textbooks? He conquered most of known Asia at the time. But at one particular point, the Seleucids attacked the Parthians with 400,000 in their army. The Ephraimites, or Parthians, only had 120,000. The Parthians lost three major battles, but they held out until the Scythian troops came down from Scythia to help them defeat the Seleucids. But this the Parthians showed that Ephraimite doggedness of refusing to give up under duress and surrendering to superior arms until Manasseh could send reinforcements to turn the tide. And there's a clear parallel in our modern time to Manasseh, the United States, helping Ephraim, who was holding out against superior weaponry and numbers. Now, because of the Seleucid defeat, much of their army was wiped out. The Maccabean Jews were able to throw off foreign rule for a time in Palestine. But most people don't realize that they were blessed because Big Brother Israel had wiped out most of the Syrian or Seleucid army, so they really only had to fight garrison troops. Now, over a millennia before the Magna Carta, the Parthians had established a system of checks and balances on the king's power. They even had a rudimentary bicameral system. Strabo, a Roman who lived just prior to Christ, stated that the council of the Parthians consists of two groups, one that of the kinsmen of the king, and the other that of the wise men and the magi. Now, Rawlinson calls them the royal house and the senate. They elected the kings of Parthia. The oldest son didn't necessarily get to be the emperor. And they had to have a concurrent vote. Both houses had to agree, but they could only be elected from the royal house, who were the kinsmen of the king. Now, the bicameral election of kings in Parthia is one of the best-kept secrets of the ancient world, or I should say best-concealed. Now, the Magi were a separate priestly class in Parthia. They were a hierarchy of priests who dated back to ancient times. They were also the sole inhabitants of many large towns and villages, which they governed as they pleased. Now, this sounds an awful lot like the priestly tribe of Levi in Joshua 21 that governed 48 independent cities as they pleased. Now, while the Romans would oppress their subjects with a heavy-handed rule, the Parthians granted liberal sovereignty to their subjects. It was, in fact, parallel to the feudal system of Europe in the Middle Ages. They had local government rule of local matters. Cities were given home rule rights. Seleucia, a city of 600,000, elected their own leaders. I wonder if they had yard signs in the ancient world. You suppose they had? They freely could elect their own mayors, although I'm sure they didn't call them mayors. Many Greek and Jewish towns were free cities. Now look at two competing opposites here, Parthia and Rome. In Parthia, you have the bicameral election of leaders. They allow local freedoms liberally. They had freedom of worship, and they didn't oppress any minorities. In Rome, the Caesars were gods. They killed people for sport in the arena. They made slaves of conquered people. They conquered the weak and oppressed them, would drag them through their circuses, drag them through their parades in Rome to utterly show how they had defeated them. I ask you, which of those two peoples was civilized? Which sounds barbarous to you? Yet all of your history books say the Romans were the great civilizers. No, they weren't. Rome was the great destroyers of the ancient world. We teach history in our textbooks from the Greco-Roman point of view, and the history of Israel's more enlightened empires is ignored. Now, in 140 BC, Parthia had an infusion of relatives, you might say. The Massagetae, who had defeated the Persians up by the Aral and Caspian Sea, they were pushed down into Parthia by the expanding Chinese and Hun populations. The Chinese called them the Yuchi. The Encyclopedia Britannica states that one of those Yuchi tribes were called the Naphthalites. Now, obviously, this was the tribe of Naphtali, or Naphtali from the Bible. Just perfect. Or it's Ephthalites, Hephthalites. The most prominent of these tribes was the Massagetae. Now, other tribal names are present, and I discuss them in my book, but I won't mention them right now. They came into Parthia and named it Sakistan after Isaac. Now, Rome at one point was ruled by a triumvirate, Caesar, Pompey, and Crassus. Crassus decided to invade Parthia. It was the first of many wars of aggression by Rome against Parthia. Now, he took time to go to Jerusalem, and he looted the temple of God of all its gold. Took a huge molten poured gold beam that it's in the records. He seemed reluctant to invade Parthia. He wanted to just loot the people there in the eastern Mediterranean. So the Parthians sent an ambassador to him to taunt him, to try to get to come and fight. Now the Romans preserved even the conversation between the ambassadors. When they taunted him, Crassus furiously replied, "He will give his answer in Parthia's capital." The ambassador of Parthia pointed to the palm of his hand and said, "Hairs will grow here, Crassus, before you ever even see Seleucia," which was a long way from the capital. The Parthians fought the Romans just with their cavalry. Their infantry was busy fighting another war, so they didn't even bring them. The Parthian light cavalry was armed with arrows, and they were continuously replenished from camel trains that rode with the cavalry. But the Parthian heavy cavalry was similar to what perhaps you've seen of the armed lancers of the Middle Ages. Again, Rawlinson writes of the Parthian heavy cavalry, "Their strong horses had their heads, necks, chest, and even their flanks protected by armor of brass or iron. Their riders had armor of the same material, helmets of iron. They carried a long spear or pike into battle, and they would bear down with great weight on the enemy or stand like an iron wall against charges." So in other words, to the Romans, they looked like the knights of the Middle Ages in their heavy cavalry, mounted on horses. The first major Roman-Parthian battle was fought at a place, if I'm pronouncing it right, Carrhae, by Syria in 53 BC. Parthia killed half the Roman army, including Crassus. In fact, they had so little respect for him, they decapitated his body because he wanted to loot all the gold from the Jews and everybody else. They decapitated his body and poured molten gold into his skull and sent it to the Romans as a gift. So they could be bloodthirsty too. A quarter of the Romans escaped, and the other quarter of that army was carried captive by Parthia to the area around Tashkent. But they treated them mercifully. They gave them wives, they gave them land, made them citizens, and made them loyal Parthians. Now, what would Rome have done to the Parthians? Would they have treated them nice? I don't think so. Now, Parthia got angry, though, at this war of invasion, so they invaded back. They drove the Romans out of Palestine, out of Syria, out of Turkey, back to Europe in around 40 AD and completely out of Asia. Herod had to flee for his life, the Herod that was ruling Palestine at that time. Palestine was ruled by a Parthian king appointed by Parthia. Josephus spills a lot of ink telling about that time. Now, it's significant to realize that Palestine was ruled by Parthia just a few decades before Jesus Christ was born. When Christ was born, there were a lot of people living in Jerusalem who remembered when Parthia ruled them. In fact, when the Parthians withdrew in 37 BC, for a time the Jews fought, took up arms to keep the Parthian ruler rather than have those Romans come back. Now, at that time, the Euphrates River became the border between the Roman and Parthian empires for centuries. To cross it with troops meant war. Now, were the 10 tribes lost at the time of Christ? No. We saw that Josephus knew where they were and said they were on the other side of that Euphrates. Now, as Christ's birth drew near, Rome invaded Parthia one more time with an army of 113,000. See, they got more respect as it went along. They started with 40,000 under Crassus. By the time the next battle came, they had 113,000 soldiers. The leader was a name you'll recognize. It was Mark Antony, famous with Cleopatra, of course, the very same gentleman. The Romans lost 43,000 dead, and they barely escaped with the rest of their army retreating across the Armenian mountains in winter. So from 36 BC to about 58 AD, there was a period of détente marking the relations between Rome and Parthia. And it was during this time that Christ was born. Now let's look at the life of Jesus Christ in the context of the Parthian-Roman geopolitics. Some things of his life will come in clearer focus. Now remember that the Magi elected Roman emperors. They were powerful enough to, if I dare use the modern word, impeach Parthian Empire emperors who went bad. And they did so in 60 BC. They kicked the emperor out and got a new one. They were devoted to the one royal family, though. And it's significant that they sent a delegation to worship Jesus Christ with royal gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Now, one of the jobs of the Magi was to keep track of where the Arsacids were, any potential throne or member of who could mount to this throne. Remember, there was another prophecy about David's seed, that the sword would not depart from his house. That also took place in Parthia, because there was no orderly progression. The oldest son didn't necessarily become king. It was whoever was elected by the Magi. Well, every heir thought, well, hey, if I kill off all my rivals, I'll be the only one left standing, and I'll be empire. And that's exactly what they did. They killed fathers, uncles, brothers, cousins, nephews, shirt-tail relations, anybody they could find to kill each other off. At times, it got hard to find one. In fact, sometime the Magi sent some of the Arsacids to Rome during this time of peace to keep them alive, to preserve the bloodline. They had to send a Scythia sometime to find one. In fact, I'll take time to mention it because it's humorous. There was one Parthian king that they didn't like, and they got rid of him. They sent him up to Scythia in exile. Well, the next king turned out to be even worse, and there was hardly any alive, so they decided, well, this guy wasn't so bad. So they sent the delegation to try to find him. He was trying to feed himself with a bow and arrow down to about his last meal when they found him and said, hey, we'd like you back. Would you like to be emperor? Talk about a sweet deal. But anyway, you can see why they were traveling to foreign lands to try to find anyone who had this blood in them. And lo and behold, the Bible tells us Jesus Christ was of the royal line of Perez, of the seed of David. In Matthew 1:3, you confirm that. So now you have the Magi showing up, who elected Parthian emperors, and the fact they came and worshiped Jesus as one of these made Jesus a possible candidate for the royal throne of Parthia because of his bloodline. The Parthian Magi included faithful servants of God to have been led by an angel to Jesus' home. And by the way, I think that star was an angel. The Bible uses that star for an angel terminology a lot. Don't confuse the legends about a great celestial sign or something. The Bible says that this star appeared, disappeared, and then reappeared to the Magi later after they'd seen Herod and warned him to flee. And also this star stood over an individual child in a home under a roof where no celestial object could shine. And also, when they came to Herod and said, you know, we've followed his star from the east, etc., Herod probably went to his astrologers, which I'm sure he had, and he said, what star? And the astrologer said, "We don't know." That's why he had to go back to the Parthians and say, "Tell me about this star. Tell me about who are you coming here to worship?" And they said, "We're coming to worship the king of the Jews." Oh, well, Herod thought he was the king of the Jews. Rome, Caesar had told him he was. Parthian Roman had battles over this in the past, who was going to rule Palestine. But did you notice that Herod treated them with great deference? He didn't provoke a fight because Augustus Caesar had ordered him, "You will not start a war with the Parthians. We can't lick them, we can't beat them, we can't fight them now." So he was under orders to keep the peace no matter what insult he took. But I think there was another reason why he treated them with such deference. It wasn't, remember, just but a few decades before the Parthians had ruled the place. Okay, now let's look at some Christmas myths here. We have this beautiful little, you know, Christmas image of three wise men, you know, with the star shining in the back on top of their camels riding into Jerusalem. Okay, Jerusalem was a major trade route between three continents, Africa, Asia, and Europe. Thousands would come in any given caravan because you had to travel in large numbers to fight off the pirates and brigands who would war on you, much like in Europe in the Middle Ages. Do you suppose that a city that was used to caravans of thousands would get scared to death by three dusty riders coming in on three tired camels with a few saddlebags? No. But the Bible tells us, it says, the whole city was affrighted. Well, I think the King James says affrighted. Others say frightened, scared by their arrival. The whole city! Look, they're back! The old guys could remember, yes, we want those Parthians back. They had good rule. Kick the Romans out. That's what the Jews were hoping. Herod had a terrible political problem on his hand. Because the secular sources state that the Jews who lived in Parthia, who were far more numerous than the Jews who lived in Judea, they sent holy day offerings for the holy days to Jerusalem. Sometimes it was so rich an offering, they were escorted by 10,000 armed men. That's almost an infantry division. Now, they were commoners in Parthia's empire. If commoners could send that large a force, what kind of a size of escorts do you suppose was accompanying the Parthian magi who picked the kings who were among the ruling classes of Parthia? What you had coming was a small army over the hill into Jerusalem. It wasn't just and by the way, I think there was at least 12 magi, one for each tribe. But they would have traveled with thousands of armed escorts, that Parthian heavy cavalry. They would have had armor bearers, cooks, seamstresses, you know, all the camp followers that follow an army. They probably moved in, started setting up their tents on the hills over Jerusalem. And no wonder Jerusalem, the whole city, was scared, because the whole city could see them. They probably thought they were about to be besieged. So Herod was actually glad and relieved to see that they were only here for a peaceful purpose, to worship the one who was born king of the Jews. But one aspect that's worth discussing here, too. Jesus Christ, I believe, was the pre-existent Son of the Most High God, God the Father, as we know Him. This was His Son coming into the earth. This was not just a gift of Parthia. This was God the Father's gift to His Son who arrived on the earth. Do you think He would have sent three dusty riders on a camel with a few saddlebags of whatever they could grab? No! There was probably a whole baggage train of gold, frankincense, and myrrh, escorted by a very large contingent of Parthian soldiers. This was God's gift to His Son, and that's also why Jesus never had to work for a living. I mean, He was a young child when He got this gift, but I think Joseph of Arimathea, who was really His uncle, took charge of this until He was of age. But that's why you see Jesus traveling with an entourage of at least 12, maybe 70, maybe 120, no visible means of support, all over Jerusalem. They walked for 3.5 years. None of them held a job. And they had money in a purse that Judas kept and said, "Should we give some more to the poor?" He was rich. He was trained as a carpenter's apprentice, yes, under Joseph. But when Jesus came of age and was about His Father's business, He had all His ministry financed because God had prepositioned the wealth so He didn't have to worry about money during His ministry. So Judas wasn't tempted by a few little coins of silver, maybe a few Roman denarii. No, no, no. He was perhaps the steward of what was left of the gift the Magi had brought. It was a large amount of money that tempted him. Now I'll have to find my place. So, but anyway, Rome knew of Parthia's keen interest in Jesus, and they handled him with kid gloves. I mean, they let him speak and travel as he wished, even if riots broke out. They didn't put him in prison. When he was on trial before Pilate, remember, Pilate kept thinking of reason after reason to keep Jesus alive. He may have known him because I think Jesus, as I bring out in my book, was an executive vice president of Joseph of Arimathea's international company. And Pilate probably knew him. He was probably a Roman citizen, which also explains, like Paul, he was able to travel wherever he wanted, unmolested. But at one point, remember, Pilate kind of must have almost nudged Jesus in the ribs and said, "Are you a king?" Now, when you understand this, what Pilate was asking him, "Are you really related to the Parthian royalty? I mean, are you royal blood over there? Are you a king?" Because he didn't want to get in a war with the Parthians, remember. He'd been worshipped by the Magi. He was afraid maybe the Parthians would declare war over this issue if they executed one of their relatives of the king. But of course we know Jesus had to die for mankind. If he had said one word in his defense, Pilate probably would have said, "Free to go." He was basically telling Jesus, it's in the Bible. And he said, "Don't you know I have the power of life and death over you? I can set you free. Say something, Jesus." And then he washed his hands saying, "This guy's innocent." You know, I mean, he tried to cover his you-know-what with both the Romans because a riot was breaking out. He didn't want a civil war rebellion either. So he covered his you-know-what both with Rome and with Parthias. And then when the cross had the words, he printed over it, says, "Here's the king of the Jews," etc. He put it in several languages in there and made it very clear that it was the Jews who wanted him dead so that there wouldn't be blame on him. Now, 1 Peter 5:13 says that Peter wrote from the city of Babylon. Many people try to explain that away. No, that was Rome, spiritual Babylon. No, it was not. Babylon was a huge city, and it was a Parthian regional city, a very major one. He was writing from Parthia. The Apostle Thomas was called by Eusebius the evangelist of Parthia. The Apostle Andrew was identified as the one who went to the Scythians by Eusebius. Now, the Apostle John in the book of Revelation, remember, it refers to Christ's second coming, and it says, when he comes, he will be the King of Kings. It says that in Revelation 19:16. John was writing to his audience at the time. His audience would have understood that the term King of Kings was the Parthian ruler's automatic title. In other words, remember the apostles also asked, "Will you at this time restore the kingdom to Israel?" They knew he was born a king. They knew the prophecies about the conquering Messiah. They wanted a conquering Messiah. They wanted the Romans out. In fact, I think some of the competition between the Pharisees that went on, remember, they were almost trying to provoke fights for Jesus with the Romans. I think some of the Pharisees understood the prophecies. They understood, well, gee, it seems like this ought to be the time when the Messiah ought to be coming. Of course, he's got to be the conquering Messiah, which means he's got to get rid of the Romans. But this Jesus, you know, he seems like the Messiah, but he won't take on the Romans. What's wrong with him? Can't he see his calling? So they were trying to provoke fights with the Herodians there so they could witness this act of rebellion to make Jesus rebel against the Romans and fight against them. Jesus wouldn't take the bait. That must have posed them no end of frustration. Of course, they didn't understand that that would be fulfilled at his second coming. But at any rate, the Apostle John was saying that when Jesus comes a second time, he'll come as the King of Kings. So what he's saying is, no, he won't set up that kingdom in our lifetime. But when he comes back the next time, that's when he will inherit the throne of David and be the King of Kings. Now, Parthia would have been much more hospitable territory to evangelize than Roman areas. The Magi were favorable. Devout Parthians came to Jerusalem on pilgrimages. And in Acts 2, it mentions Parthians, Elamites, etc. Some of these areas were regions of Parthia. And they were devout followers of God coming there. And it wasn't just Jews who lived there. It says Jews and proselytes. So they were non-Jews who were obeying too, and I think they were Israelite. Even when Peter was addressing the crowd, we have his sermon in Acts, he says, "Men of Judah?" No. All of these foreigners are there, and he says, "Men of Israel," he addresses them. So he knew who they were. We've read over that. Now, there were very few Arsacids left alive in Parthia due to them murdering each other off. But in 51 A.D. in the apostolic period, three brothers settled the whole thing amicably, if I might say so, in a Christian manner. One of these brothers became the emperor, and the two others agreed to be regional rulers and stop killing each other. And it was settled peacefully during the apostolic period when Christianity was spreading there. Now, in the 2nd century A.D., Parthia changed the inscriptions on their coins from Greek Hellenic expressions to Semitic or Aramaic or the descendants of Hebrew on their coins. Now, why would the Parthians do that unless they had rediscovered their Israelite roots? Rome invaded Parthia again in 114 A.D., and it was a very, very strange war. Up to this time, if Rome crossed the Euphrates River, Parthia came right back, or vice versa. They hit each other right away. And in fact, as one digression that's in the book, I believe that when the Magi came with a large army, and the Romans thought that they were going to be besieged in Jerusalem, technically that was an act of war by the Parthians, because to cross the Euphrates with a large army or any troops meant war. Well, Herod no doubt wrote about this to Caesar and said, you got to send more troops out here. These Parthians are getting active. And so just a few, you know, back at that time, you didn't send armored transports and C-5s and send the infantry over like we do to the Persian Gulf. It took years to outfit an army, get up the foodstuffs, march them all, you know, across the Mediterranean world into Asia. So a few years later, Rome brought an army, for some reason, to the Euphrates River. And you had both the Roman and the Parthian armies lined up on either side of the Euphrates, ready to go to war. And Gaius Caesar for the Romans and the Parthian emperor met in neutral territory. The only one they could find was an island in the Euphrates River. Now, because it had to be neutral territory for the politics of it, for the diplomacy. They agreed to settle it without a war. But I think there's a real chance that the reason that near war took place was because of the Magi and their entourage who had come to Jerusalem without Roman permission into their territory. So Jesus' birth almost started a war, in my judgment. Now, back to the strange war in 114 AD. The Emperor Trajan personally led one of the most massive invasions at that time. Now, this is when Christianity was spreading in Parthia. There's records that some of the sub-kings of Parthia had adopted Judaism. And when they say Judaism in the text, it may have been a form of Christianity. Because remember, Christianity or the Nazarenes was, they went to synagogue at that time with the Jews and were thought of as a sect of the Jews when they started out. Antioch and 9 other cities were the places where Trajan camped. An earthquake hit, which hit Antioch and those 9 cities were the Roman and none others. Rawlinson wrote, the quakes were of unequaled violence, and this is his words, it seemed as if Providence had determined that the glories of Rome would be obscured by calamities that no human power could avert. Trajan marched deeper into Parthia, all the way to the Persian Gulf, and this is rare that the Parthians didn't fight. Well, Trajan was he was imagining himself a reborn Alexander, going around on a barge on the Persian River, and I think he was the one distressed that his advanced age meant that he could no longer conquer India. Well, at that particular time, the subject people all revolted all along his route to get rid of the Romans because they couldn't stand Roman rule. The Parthians didn't even have to fight to get their territory back. The subject people all revolted and started killing the Romans. Trajan began a long retreat, but guess who made war with him the whole way? Not Parthia, nature. The Parthian forces just followed and reoccupied the territory as he left. They never had to fight a battle. Trajan's army was plagued by excessive heat, swarms of flies, violent hailstorms, etc. And he died soon afterwards. This sounds a lot like the plagues of Egypt. Now, Rome was apparently afraid of Parthia's god after this, as the next Caesar, who was Hadrian, tried to appease Parthia's god by yielding a substantial territory to Parthia as a gift. That was unprecedented in their history. In Rome's mind, they were just surrendering to the gods. But I can't help but wondering if at that particular time there was an unknown prophet we haven't read about that said, stand back, the battle is the Lord's, because that's the way they acted. Now, history repeated itself a little later in 163 to 165 when another Roman invasion was turned back by nature. The Emperor Lucius Verus led it with Avidius Cassius, and this time they went deeper, but suddenly a plague broke out. So horrible was the plague that it clung to the Romans like a death march all the way back through the provinces. The classical writers add that it raged with special force in the Rhine and Atlantic, in Italy. More than half the population of Rome was killed by it, and almost the whole army. That's according to their own historians. The Romans, again, believed this was a supernatural punishment. Now, the final Roman-Parthian war, and remember, your ancestors lived these events. Someday in the resurrection, we'll be able to meet these people. You probably had ancestors who fought in Parthia's heavy cavalry, who saw some of these events, who fought the Romans, etc. But the Rome's emperor Caracalla, in about 215 AD, proposed marrying a daughter of Parthia's emperor to end their long hostilities. Well, the Israelite mind can be deceived when it's weary of war and it wants to believe the Cold War is over. They're all nice guys now. Well, Parthia accepted the offer, and they didn't even get suspicious when the Romans brought a huge army with them to Parthia's capital to escort the emperor. Well, the records state that the Parthians had declared a holiday. They were all in their party dress. You know, they had the place festooned with banners and everything, welcoming the Romans, because after all, the Roman emperor had promised that he was going to be the son-in-law of their own Parthian emperor by marrying the daughter. Well, unfortunately, the Romans drew up their army and they started killing everybody in Parthia's capital when they were unarmed. The emperor barely escaped with his life. But then the Romans did something. They desecrated the royal Parthian cemetery and they scattered all the bones of all the dead kings of Parthia, the seed of David. They did great violence to it. Parthia became so enraged, they waged a war of revenge against Rome. The two armies met in a war of annihilation near a place called Nisibis, near the Turkey-Syria border. One of the greatest battles of the ancient world, censored out of your history books. Each was led personally by its emperor. They called in all the reinforcements they could. 3 days of constant killing occurred. If you've seen the movie Braveheart, which I did, very bloody, but you can see, some people say, boy, I wish we could live in Bible days. That's what Bible days were, folks. You got out your sword and you hacked each other's arms and legs and torsos apart until somebody gave up and left. You couldn't get armies apart very quickly once their adrenaline got going and they started fighting. So that's why it went on for 3 days. The historians of that time say the dead were so numerous, they were piled to such a height, you could hardly even maneuver armies anymore. A great deal of the tactics of that war and what happened is in my book, and I can't go into it now. Parthia won. Rome had to return all their captives, all the booty they had taken from Parthia in their war of deceit, and they had to pay a huge war indemnity to Parthia out of their treasury. But Parthia was badly depleted by the war. It was a Pyrrhic victory, for those of you who follow history. And in 220 AD, Persia, one of their provinces, revolted. In 226, another 3-day battle occurred, which Persia won. However, the last Parthian emperor was recorded that he sought to, not to God, he sought to the occult for advice prior to this last war, just like Saul did. The Parthians quickly disappeared from Asian history, and he was the last Parthian emperor when that happened. Now, one final point as we leave the Parthians. Josephus writes a lot about him. Now, Josephus, remember, was a good Pharisee. He had the same anti-Gentile bias as the Pharisees and even the apostles of Christ had. Why was he so interested in the Parthians? Well, it's recorded that Josephus regarded the Parthians as familiar with Hebrew. In fact, it says he wrote his history of the Jewish wars in his own native tongue for the benefit of the Parthians, among whom he declares he had many readers. No, you have a Jewish Pharisee writing a lot of Israelite history to the Parthians so they can catch up on it. I think that shows that Josephus knew they were Israelite. And of course, we saw his quote, remember, where he said the 10 tribes are beyond Euphrates. Well, remember, beyond Euphrates, it was a euphemism for in Parthia. If you live in Texas, or probably New Mexico, if someone tells you, I think I want to go across the Rio Grande, do some shopping, you understand immediately, that's a euphemism, I'm going to Mexico. It was the same in Josephus' time. The Euphrates River had been the ironclad border between Rome and Parthia. So if you said, if you were in Roman soil, and you said, I'm going beyond Euphrates, you meant in Parthia. I think Josephus was helping them rediscover their Israelite heritage, and he intended to. Now, when Parthia fell, Parthia had the Persian Gulf to the south. They had enemies to the west and east. The only friendly border was the Scythians to the north, and the only ones of those that were really independent yet were by the Black Sea. So northwest toward Europe was the only option that they had, because the Persians executed the Semitic people. They waged the jihad, if I can use that term, against everyone who was Semitic. They wanted to get rid of any. They especially hated Semitic religion. So they persecuted anyone who had a Semitic religion, Christianity or Judaism. They wanted Zoroastrianism back. So everybody had a real strong motive, living, to leave. So Armenia was ruled by the relatives of the Parthian kings, though, and that was the one Parthian province that stayed independent. The Parthian royal house continued to rule there for 200 more years. Now in 256 AD, now the Parthians fell in 226 AD. By 256 AD, so many people had spilled through those gates of the Caucasus, up over the Black Sea, around them to the north and into the Eastern Europe, Balkans, Armenia couldn't hold them all, but these people were called the Caucasians because they were squeezed through the Caucasus Mountains. There were millions of them that poured into Europe. By 256 AD, the Getae, or Goths, came pouring into the Balkans and drove the Romans out. And by the way, there was a little payback there. Remember when the Romans had come in and deceived the Parthians and they sacked their capital? They killed every man, woman, and child, I think it was, in the Parthian, at least western capital. Ctesiphon was the name. So there was older Parthians who remembered that, leading those troops probably when they came into the Balkans. The first huge Roman city which they came to was called Philippopolis. They did the same thing to the Romans as the Romans had done to them. They killed every man, woman, and child. They were extremely brutal and had no mercy. And I think that was payback time to the Romans, who frankly deserved a lot of payback. They were cruel to population after population after population. So they had it coming, frankly. Now, by 286 AD, the Saxons, or the Sacae, were first mentioned as being in the area of the North Sea, and they came in greater numbers after that. But some of the groups of Parthia were called the Sacae, or Sacans, the Kermans, and the Jats. Now, just shortly after that, we see pouring into Europe the Saxons, the Germans, and the Jutes arriving, phonetically almost identical. Millions of Israelites migrated into Europe under the term Caucasian. I mean, these people didn't come from the moon, people. You know, when you read the ancient histories, they talk about, well, the Goths and the Germans and the Anglo-Saxons and the Vandals and the Alans and all these people, they poured by the millions into Asia. They never tell you where they came from. They don't tell you that a giant empire had just fallen that was Semitic, that was pouring through there. They had to get out, that they were the ancient enemies of Rome and had a strong motive to wage war against Rome. Now, one tribe stayed in Asia until the 5th or 6th centuries. That was the Nephthalites. They became known as the Nephthalite Huns, and they stayed and waged war against the Persians for centuries, yet before they finally left too. Now, Edward Gibbon's Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire states that the Parthian system exhibited a lively image of the feudal system which later prevailed in Europe. Now, the Goths and Vandals were Israelite people and Christian when they came into contact with the Romans. The Goths and Vandals spoke a common language. They had a Bible in their own tongue as early as 383 AD. We know they had 2 Corinthians, portions of all four Gospels, Paul's letters, and Ezra and Nehemiah, and probably others that we just don't know about. But Alaric, the great Visigoth leader, was a Christian, and when the Goths conquered Rome in 410 AD, Rome was not sacked by the barbarians, quote-unquote. The Encyclopedia Britannica, as common a source as that, says, there's no reason to attribute any excessive destruction of the buildings to Alaric and his army. In fact, contemporary ecclesiastics, that means the priests of the Catholic Church of the time, recorded with wonder many instances of their clemency and their protection of vast multitudes. The Vandals, one of the Gothic groups, they migrated clear through Europe. A main body went through Spain, crossed Spain in a fleet of ships, went down to Africa, conquered Carthage, which was a Roman city at the time, and Carthage became their headquarters for about a little less than a century, and they ruled the Mediterranean with their fleets. They finally lost a war and disappeared from the old world again. Where do you suppose they went? They lived in Carthage. They had access to the Carthaginian histories and records of this secret land beyond the Gibraltar as a place of refuge. I think they took those ships and they went across the Atlantic. And there's a hint of this in Barry Fell's book, where he says that a prayer stick in one of the Indian tribes, I think it was the Kickapoo of Wisconsin, had in their possession a prayer stick when you translated it, it was from the time of the Vandals and their occupation of North Africa. Now, the Vandals also did not wreck Rome. That's where we get the term vandalism. Well, we believe the press of the Romans, frankly, again here. Their propaganda made it into the textbooks. The Britannic, again, says they took the wealth in an orderly fashion as a prize of war, but they didn't vandalize the place. In fact, it was nothing compared to what Rome did to you if you lost to Rome. So the Saxon, Gothic, and Germanic people settled in Britain and Europe. It took a while to sort everyone out and get settled, so you have the descendants of the old kingdom of Israel that were in Asia melding with and fighting with the descendants of the colonies of old Israel, who were called the Celtic people. Now let's, in conclusion, discuss the modern identities of the tribes. The Israelite tribes remained in Britain, Scandinavia, Northwest Europe, and then they spread to North America, New Zealand, South Africa, Australia. And I want to briefly mention an obscure prophecy to you, which I've never heard quoted in any Sabbatarian church. It's in the 2 Samuel 7:10. It's Nathan the prophet who brought this prophecy from God to David. And he says to David, I will appoint a place for my people Israel and will plant them, that they will dwell in a place of their own and move no more. Now God was going to move them from Israel to a place and they would move no more. He obviously wasn't Palestine, because that's where they were going to move from. But our prophetic expectation should incorporate this prophecy that God said the Israelites would move no more once they reached that final destination. So where are they today? I believe Ephraim and Manasseh, on which the name Israel was placed, and were a nation of company of nations, are the United States and Great Britain. I believe the United States is Manasseh, and Great Britain, Canada, Australia, New Zealand are Ephraim, and my book has a lot of evidence on that. One gentleman asked where I stand on the Ephraim and Manasseh issue, which is the United States and which is Britain. Well, frankly, from a salvation point, and even prophetic point, it's not a dime's worth of difference, because in Genesis 49, it refers to them even jointly as Joseph, in a prophecy about the latter days. If you want more information on this, I can give it to you, and my book does have it. I do believe the Jews constitute modern Judah and portions of Levi and Benjamin. The Israelis fulfill Genesis 49's prophecy about Judah being a young lion over its prey in the latter days. In other words, a young nation that's militaristic, but they're young in the latter days. Zephaniah 2:7 says that the remnant of Judah would have the seacoast of Palestine. That's exactly where the Jewish mandate area was under the British division. The partition that was supposed to be between the Jewish state and the Arab state in 1947 was the seacoast of Palestine, exactly where God put them. Some of you are probably familiar with theories that the Ashkenazi Jews are just Edomites, Khazars, etc. I've read extensively in that, and frankly, it doesn't hold water, because the Parthian Jews were more numerous than the Jews of Judea. Basically, I'm oversimplifying, but the Sephardic Jews are the descendants of the Jews that were in Judea and spilled into the Mediterranean world. The Ashkenazi are the Asian who came through, you know, the Ukraine, Black Sea, same route as Israel. Those Parthian Jews, of which there were an awful lot, remember, they didn't go to the moon, people. They went with Israel up in that direction. That's why you had so many Jews in the Ukraine, Poland, eastern regions of Europe. And the term Ashkenazi actually identifies them as Parthian. The Persians referred to the Parthians as the Ashkan. It's a little derivative of Yitzhak, but Ashkan, it comes in there. So when you have the Ashkenazi Jews, what they're really proclaiming is that they are the descendants of the Parthian Jews. So remember that the next time you read something that says the Jews are all Edomites or something worse. No, that's not true. They're our brethren. Also, in Zechariah 12, you should look for the tribe of Judah in the non-Christian people. It says when Jesus Christ, well, it doesn't say that in Zechariah, but that's our understanding who the Messiah is. When he comes, it says the people of Judah and Levi will set themselves apart in mourning when they find out who their conquering Messiah is. They're weeping. It says they set themselves apart. And it's the one who they have pierced. Obviously, Jesus Christ. So the Bible has a prophecy that Jews are not going to accept him till he comes as the conquering Messiah. Now, Reuben, it says, was to have the excellency of dignity. I'm quoting from Genesis 49. Instability and loose sexual mores. The French have had the museums and the pomp of greatness and contended with Britain, Joseph, for the supremacy for centuries in Europe. And really what you have is the true oldest tribe, Reuben, trying to fight for that birthright which God had given to Ephraim and Manasseh. That's why France and England warred for centuries. But finally England won it because God said Ephraim and Manasseh would have that birthright. Now the French have had about 30 governments since World War II. They fit the instability. French physical appetites are legendary. Now, I'll bet you thought I could go through this whole message without mentioning our dearest President Clinton and Monica Lewinsky. You're wrong. The French, you've seen probably reports of other international newspapers. The Italian newspaper Le Monde referred to the Clinton presidency as, I think, a dead corpse. I think I saw, I forget the source or I'd credit it, but it was an Arabic newspaper that basically said our president couldn't even control his own harem. The English tabloids you can't even quote in mixed company and over here, but the French newspaper Le Monde said, where's the problem? So what? I mean, at François Mitterrand's funeral, some of you may have seen it. He's, you know, the premier of France. When François Mitterrand died, his wife and his mistress were openly there, weeping together at the funeral. I mean, no wonder the French fit Reuben. Enough said on that issue. They're Reuben. Zebulun was to dwell at the haven of the sea and be a haven for ships. Well, Holland's land is literally saved from the sea by its famous system of dikes. Rotterdam is the number one port in Europe. So Zebulun, I believe, is Holland. Issachar, it said, was to be a strong ass or donkey couched down between two burdens and become a servant to tribute. Now, Finland has been sandwiched between Germany and Russia at the first part of this century, and then between the East Bloc and the West Bloc. And they really have been a very neutralist country, which doesn't have a lot of independence between the two. And the term Finlandization even refers to this phenomenon. Now, I dearly wanted to put something in my book, which I'll mention here. It may not be true. It's anecdotal, but I'm going to give it to you. A very good friend of mine, at the time, although I've lost track with him now, he told me that in World War I, Count Mannerheim of Finland rallied his people to arms with the battle cry that they fought under the banner of Issachar. Now, I dearly wanted to put that in there, but I even wrote the Finnish embassy saying, this is my quote, can you verify whether this is true or not? Well, they sent me travel brochures. So they didn't want to discuss it either. But I think that Issachar is Finland based on their history in the 20th century. It says, Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel and be an adder in the path. Now, I think we have the right people, but I think we have the wrong reason. The Hebrew concordance has judge as discern his people. Now, Dan's habit of naming everything after forefather Dan through history where they migrated shows that you can discern where Israel went in history by following the names of Dan. Also, the term adder in the path, you can follow the path of Israel. Have you seen those nature documentaries of a sidewinder snake? You know, where it leaves these lines in the desert. Even though the sidewinder's long gone, you can follow its path as a snake along the way. And I think that's the analogy that's being referenced here. So you can follow the Israelites by following Dan, the Tuatha de Danann, located in Ireland. But Dan was located in more than one place in the ancient world. Remember, they said, our territory is too small here in Palestine. So a number of them went up to Lachish, conquered it, and renamed it Dan. So you had from Dan to Beersheba, you know, as the territories of Israel from then on. Also, a number of the Danites fought with the Sea Peoples and were called the Danann. In the book of Judges, remember Deborah's song refers to the Danites. It says they abode in ships at the very same time that you have Sea Peoples named after Dan. Now, the Tuatha de Danann located in Ireland, but also Denmark has a Danite name in a maritime history. So they're very good candidates for Danite as well. Naphtali says was to be a hind let loose, and in that they would giveth goodly words. Now, that's fairly cryptic, but the term hind let loose is like a female deer in the rutting season. Now, you think of sexual appetites, and Sweden is associated, again, with a great deal of moral looseness in the latter days, and the lovely film star blondes, you know, who are movie stars. Giveth goodly words, in a concordance, can also be said or rendered as gives beautiful speeches. Now, Sweden gives beautiful speeches every year. They're reported in all the world's press. We call them the Nobel Prizes. And I think that fills this prophecy. Asher, it says, was to yield royal dainties. That's very obscure to the point of being butchered in the King James, frankly. Yield royal delights is better. Now, what would you bring as a king to delight a king? Well, what did all the nations bring Solomon? They brought gold. What did the Magi bring Christ? They brought gold. You always brought gold as your first gift if you wanted to impress a king. Now, Asher also was recorded as the mining tribe of ancient Israel in the area of Britain. One of the tribes or sub-tribes of Asher was named after Heber. You have the consonants HBR, and two place names in the British Isles still have their name. The Hebrides as HBR, and also for a time Ireland was known as Hibernia as an ancient name, which preserved the name of an Asherite clan. Now, the Union of South Africa was settled from people in Britain and Holland going down there. They're famous for mining. The land yields gold. So I think the best odds-on favorite for Asher is South Africa. Benjamin was to raven as a wolf. Now, the wolves live in northern climates, usually, is where they're associated at. Norway and Iceland are the only nations not yet identified in this area, the northern part, and both nations have a Viking heritage. Now, it also says the Benjamites were to devour their prey and divide spoil. Now, this was what their Viking ancestors did. And remember, it's similar to the book of Judges. Remember, the tribe of Benjamin, frankly, was foolish enough to basically declare war on everybody else among the Israelites, and they almost got wiped out. And the Vikings did the same thing. They raided and preyed on all the other tribes from their maritime ships for a time. And Benjamin was very independent-minded. And so anyway, I think the Benjaminites were Norway and Iceland. If it means anything to you, I'm half Norwegian. On my mother's, is a pure-blooded Norwegian, so I'm dominant Benjamin, although my name is British Celtic, Collins. And Gad, it says, a troop shall overcome him, but he shall overcome at the last. Now, in our tradition, I think we made a mistake in this particular area. By the line, you've probably pretty well tracked with me with our traditional understandings. But the process of elimination leaves only one major nation in Europe that fits that description, and that is Germany, which was overcome by a troop of nations in World War I and II, but have overcome at the last and are now one of the most powerful nations on earth in economics and finance. Now, much of Germany has been traditionally known by the name of Isaac. The German term is Saxony. You have Upper Saxony, you have Lower Saxony. I mean, there was a third province for a time, or Länder, that was named after Isaac. Now, Germans were one of the major groups who settled the 13 colonies of the United States. The English and the Germans were here in very large numbers. And German, I don't know if many of you realize this, almost became the official language of the United States. Our early Congress had a vote on whether English or German was going to be the national language of the United States of America. You know what the margin was? English won by one vote in the Congress. So don't ever think your vote doesn't count. But anyway, think how history might have been different in World War I, in World War II, if we had been a German-speaking nation. So I think God had, who knows the end from the beginning, made sure that that vote went that way. Okay, now it's also likely that the Germans do include the Assyrians. I feel that the Assyrian tradition is more the Prussian, East German area, and the Western Germans are more the Israelite. In fact, you can see when the Iron Curtain came down, the Western Germans inherited the blessings of Abraham, the wealth and the prosperity. The Prussian or Eastern Germans could only watch it on TV. So I think God himself made a division here on which was which. Excuse me. It says Simeon and Levi were to be scattered in Israel, so we can't name them within a specific country. But we know the Simoni came to Britain in about 720, and so that's one area. Now, Wales and Scotland were held by the Celts, who had a tremendous martial military tradition. I mean, the Romans never fully conquered them. They were fierce fighters. Also, the states of the old American Confederacy had many Celts in it. And also, Sparta, the famous Greek colony. I point out in my book the quotations from Spartan kings who wrote to the high priests and carried on a correspondence with the high priests of Judah, the Jews in Jerusalem. They acknowledged, they searched their record and said, you know what, we're related. They said, our forefathers were related, or were a related tribe to your people. And interestingly, when you look in Simeon, in the numbers in the Bible, when they left Egypt, they had a pretty large tribe. Over half of it disappeared very shortly thereafter. And I think the Simeonites, who were prone to acting, you know, without thinking about it, just acting it and doing it, like when they took the sword to avenge Dinah along with Levi, I think those Simeonites went elsewhere, and one of the places they settled was Sparta. By their own tradition, they felt they were related to the Israelites. Now, the Israel identity or identification of them was widely known in the United States and Britain in the last century. The people in Britain knew it in Queen Victoria's government. A minister named Pitts in the United States in 1857 spoke to a joint session of Congress 2 days. And the subject was the Israelite identity of the United States and the fact that the United States and Russia would be the end-time enemies because Ezekiel 38 and 39 said so. Can you imagine the Congress of our United States sitting in joint session for 2 days to hear a message like this about the Israelite heritage and prophecy about the Bible? Shows how far downhill we have gone, people. But and this is an important point that I put toward the end deliberately so it would fix in everyone's mind. The Israelite ancestry is not of itself any statement of racial supremacy. Please understand that. All races are eligible for salvation, as the New Testament shows. We follow the Israelites to see that God kept his promises to the people, so that we know that when we read the Bible, we can believe the word of a God who kept his promises. That's why we need to follow. And also, you can't possibly understand prophecy unless you know who the Israelites are, because it says they're going to have a major role in the latter days. So you can't possibly be right unless you know where they are. And that goes for Sunday-keeping churches, Sabbath-keeping churches. I mean, there's churches in our religious tradition who have given up talking about this message of Israel. I'm not naming names today. But I say, shame on them. How can you be a work of a watchman if you won't tell, if you don't know who you're going to, if you won't tell them who they are, you won't tell them where they've been, you won't tell them where they're going out of the Bible, and you say you're a watchman? I mean, if you were going to hand somebody a map who was lost, and you gave them a map and said, now this map won't show where you came from, it won't show where you're going to go down the road, but here's the map, haven't I done you a great service? Well, how good is that? Do you think God is pleased with people who call themselves watchmen and have a very lukewarm message, a bland, safe message, but won't tell them really the facts of their own heritage? Well, that's, I think, what we need to be doing. It's a vital part of restoring true values, or the restitution of all things. Now, Ezekiel 47 and Leviticus 19 show that people of any race, repeat, any race, can join the Israelite tribes and be as one born in the land, just as the same. So people, we don't have any of this Israelite supremacy stuff. We are not supremacists whatsoever, and neither am I. I hope this is on the video so I never get tagged with that. My book disassociates itself from any kind of message of racial supremacy. The Bible does not have that message. Christ and God had problems with the apostles in the New Testament. They wouldn't go to the Gentiles. They didn't want to even eat with them. I mean, it took a miracle in Peter's dream to even go to the to even let Gentiles in to talk to them. Remember the vision where he had three unclean meat dropped down three times? That was coincidentally, because as soon as he woke up, here's three Gentiles. And then Peter said, you know, some people say, ah, see, rise, Peter, kill and eat. This means we can eat anything that crawls, slithers, or creeps on the earth or underneath the ocean. No, it doesn't. Even Peter says later in the book of Acts, he says, oh, now I get it. He says, I understand I should not treat any man as if they're unclean. So anyway, neither should we. Now, identifying Israel's nations is critically important to understanding prophecy. If God gave us so many clues in Genesis 49 to find them, I think he meant for us to act on those clues. Well, I hope you have a better understanding of what happened to the Israelites in the ancient world and what happened to your ancestors. Since the reign of David, there has never, repeat, never been a time when there was not a nation of free Israelites on earth being ruled over by the seed of David. This has ramifications for our latter-day scenarios, people, and I'd like to leave you with a little bit of hope here. God never allowed all the Israelites to be captured at one time in history, ever. He can't, and keep his promise to David. He said David's seed, well, I had Perez up here, that's David's seed, will be ruling over the house of Israel till Shiloh come, or until Christ comes, whose kingdom is going to be the seed of David, the throne of David, forever and ever. But if there's no free Israelites being ruled over by a descendant of David, God's promise fails, and I don't think he's going to allow that to happen. Now, when Christ comes, the true knowledge of history will be taught to all the world. The veil of the deceit that's over this world will be removed. But hopefully you've had at least a little bit of a peek under that veil today. I could only hit the highlights of the book, but I hope you'll be interested in seeing the rest of the details. There's books here for sale, and I'll sign them as long as I'm here, which will be probably a couple more days anyway. If we run out, I can take orders here and mail them and sign them when I return home. So the check should be made out for $17, I think, to Church of God Ministry, as Lon Lacey bought the cases that are here. If they run out, then you can make them out to me. And rather than answer questions on it, I'll just mention briefly, there are discounts if you have church fellowship groups, churches, or people that want to get together and order more than one. You can get a discount. It's on the tape where you can get it, but if you want to write it down, two or three books, the price is $18 per book, and these are including all the shipping charges. 4 to 10 books is $14, 11 to 19 books is $12.50 each, and 20 or more books is $11 each. You can send it to Stephen Collins, P.O. Box 88735, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, 57109. There's flyers in the back, too, and I'll be happy to send those out to anybody who wants to write for them if you want to distribute them or learn more about it. Again, those prices include the shipping fees. And with that, I'm ready for any questions, as long as we have time. Well, the Hyksos was really, and of course you're talking about an Egyptian people, the people that invaded Egypt as probably Semitic invaders. That really was not an area of research in my book. You're really looking back at the time of Israel's exodus and before King David and Solomon. Since no one's an expert on everything, believe me, neither am I. And so since that's not an area that was in the time frame covered by my book, I honestly don't know for sure. Okay. Well, I was raised Lutheran, and at age 19, I came into the Worldwide Church of God, so I started keeping the Sabbath in 1969 at that particular time. In 1978, I was marked in disfellowship from the Worldwide Church of God for the high offense of listening to a sermon tape by Ron Dart. That's it. The minister, I mean, we're supposed to be forgiving, so I'm not going to name him. But the minister who called me and said, "You can't come back," said he had a memo here. I don't know who it was signed by, but I have a suspicion that anybody listening to tapes from Ron Dart or the CGI at that time has to be disfellowshipped and marked. So that was why I was gone. And now, in a time when you listen to tapes from any organization you want to, I find it amusing that I had to go through, frankly, so much hell at that particular time for something that's now common. At that time, I was with the CGI for about 7-8 years, and then I was with ACD, the Association for Christian Development, which, if you remember, Ken Westby, Dr. Charles Dorothy. I appreciated your mention of Charles Dorothy. He came to be a very good friend of mine, and in fact, I quote him in my book and credit him where the parts that he reviewed and proved as correct. But I talked to Charles just weeks before he died, when he had lymphoma and the chemotherapy was so strong he couldn't even get out of bed and move hardly. He was one of the most honest and humble scholars I've ever met. Like you mentioned, he had two real doctorates. And yet he was humble to the point of being self-effacing. When United was formed, I started attending with United in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. ACD didn't really have a group, and it was good to have some like-minded fellowship again. So when my injury permits me to go, you know, I've been sporadic, but I still identify myself with United Church of God now. The fellow who looks after the hall says our time is up, so I guess that's the last question. I'll be able to talk to you while I'm here yet for another couple of days.